Welcome to Open Spaces, Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melanie Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Endangered Species Act is in the news this week, and Senator Barrasso wants to give more power to states.
These state agencies are in the field every day working to protect wildlife.
A new project spearheaded by the University of Wyoming is trying to create a new niche ag market for the state.
So now the craft fur industry is actually really vibrant. What if we did this with this grain?
In Wyoming's Lake Mud are thousands of years' worth of history, and tiny microbes are the memory keepers.
I find it totally amazing to think that out there, living in the bottom of some lake, are these tiny microbes we can't see, and they can tell us about how much warmer was it here 10,000 years ago.
Plus interviews with two more political candidates. Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. As you've likely heard on NPR today, the Trump administration is proposing sweeping changes to the Endangered Species Act, but they're actually late to the party. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso has been leading the GOP effort within Congress to revamp the decades-old legislation that was set up to protect animals on the brink of extinction back in 1973. It hasn't been reauthorized since 1992. And as Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, many Republicans are now calling for drastically overhauling the proposal.
The current version of the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, just isn't cutting it for Republicans, and Barrasso is set on overhauling it altogether. He's the chair of the powerful Committee on Environment and Public Works, a post he used to release draft legislation to revamp the law.
What I want to do is modernize and update the Endangered Species Act so that we actually have recovery plans in place to help species fully recover rather than just keep them kind of on in the intensive care unit.
Barrasso's bill calls for improved transparency in the endangered species listing process, and it seeks to include more state and local input in the process. Barrasso says state-level conservation efforts are going well, and bureaucrats in Washington often just get in the way.
So the substantial resources of the states are not located in Washington, D.C. These state agencies are in the field every day working to protect wildlife.
Wyoming Governor Matt Mead was in Washington recently to testify on behalf of Barrasso's draft legislation. He was chair of the Western Governors Association, and from that post, he led an effort to gain support for an effort similar to Barrasso's, which is why he's supportive of this new bill.
Addressing root problems would obviate the need for Congress to intervene with respect to individual species. That would be better legislation, better policy, and better for wildlife. The chairman's discussion draft offers real bipartisan, which is so critical, way to correct deficiencies in the ESA implementation while maintaining science-based decision-making.
But Democrats beg to differ. Senator Tom Carper of Delaware is the committee's lead Democrat. He says the proposed bill has numerous flaws, including a lack of resources.
Legislation that we're holding this hearing on today does not provide a meaningful funding solution for species conservation. Instead, the legislation proposes several changes to the act that cause, for me, some real concerns.
New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker says the new endangered species rewrite is actually unwinding a vital federal law.
So given this extinction crisis, I just believe that we're considering a bill that in its total conception is taking us in the wrong direction. It's a step in the wrong direction.
Instead, Booker and other Democrats say the biggest problem remains a lack of resources on the ground, and they say that's the federal government's role. But Governor Mead pushed back against those cries. To him, the ESA overhaul will boost conservation without new spending.
So now we have an opportunity to improve the Endangered Species Act for wildlife and for people. We can encourage innovative conservation practices that obviate the need to list species. We can facilitate faster and more cost-effective species recovery.
Barrasso's bill doesn't do away with the federal role, as some critics contend. Under it, both the Secretary of the Interior and the Secretary of Commerce maintain the power to overrule states' recommendations in regards to the ESA. While critics disagree, Barrasso maintains his bill is a compromise.
For 30 years, defenders of the status quo have prevented prior Congresses and administrations from improving the law.
The partisan views laid out in the hearing don't seem to signal a clear path forward for reforming the ESA. At the heart of the debate is an age-old party battle. Who should have more power, the state or federal government? Even with a willingness to reach across the aisle, can the parties iron out their differences? For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Wyoming's energy resources are famous in the U.S., but they also play a role internationally. Coal markets are doing better now in the past several years, partially thanks to increasing exports and international prices. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with Dr. Robert Eichard to get a broad view on the future of coal, renewable energy, and more. Dr. Eichard has been a leader in energy transformation and security for years within the State Department, worked with the U.S. Agency for International Development and Department of Energy. Eichard begins by explaining Wyoming coal's international position.
Big markets of the future are going to be the developing world, with Asia being accounting for a half or so of that market. Those markets are headed toward more diversity, and the cost of the renewable systems are going down, so there's a growth in that transition toward renewables in most of the regions. Coal, as I said, is still a very, very strong market in Asia. And Asia is a major market, but not the only market. Europe is a big market. And so I think that there will be continued opportunities for export. How much growth you'll see, given European policies and given this competition with Australia and Indonesia in the Asian market, it may be difficult for the U.S. to compete in some of those, although coal companies have said that, you know, that they could export more coal from Wyoming to these markets if you had the ability to get the coal out.
With a trend moving towards alternative energy sources, but also an increasing coal market, how does that mix affect a state like Wyoming?
I think that generally it makes sense from an energy security standpoint and reliability standpoint to have some diversification in your energy system. And so obviously the big discussion has, from what I can tell, has been on wind and how much wind and, you know, and what the economics of that are vis-a-vis coal, et cetera. It's not just Wyoming. It's the future of the industry depends on low-cost coal and its competitiveness and the markets in Texas and in other states where these exports are going. And the trend is, to some extent, it's unfortunate, but it's a reality that the coal plants, many of which are old, are being shut down. And utilities are moving to upgrade their facilities and move to other sources. And how fast that process takes place, we'll have to see. And at the same time, I think, talking to a lot of the utilities, they don't want to become over-dependent on gas. So we'll still have a lot of coal capacity. We have 250,000 megawatts or something like that.
So it's clear there will be a need for coal for the foreseeable future, but a lot of people are highly opinionated at the current administration's efforts to bolster that market, both positive and negative. What do you think of those efforts?
I have to think we have to be honest in saying that we want to move toward cleaner, more efficient systems. From that standpoint, the older plants, utilities are deciding on the basis of economics and market that it's not worth the cost to upgrade these systems and that other sources are cheaper. So we're also dealing with this issue of, you know, affordable power and the longer-term investment requirements of these utilities, because obviously, you know, you could build ultra-critical coal plants that would be much more efficient and much less polluting. But right now, they're a lot more expensive than the alternatives, either gas or wind, for instance. And so that's a big dilemma. In Asia, China, for instance, is building these plants because the government is helping to finance it. I mean, the longer-term issue is that the trend is clear, but the question is there technology that will be coming along in terms of the carbon capture, storage, and utilization issues that will mean that you can develop systems using gas or coal that can capture the CO2 and address that critical question.
So you're saying it's a good long-term investment because coal's going to stick around for a while. Here's a way to make it viable again.
Yeah, I mean, and it's globally it's important. And the U.S., you know, has one of the largest coal resources in the world.
So there's a diplomatic aspect to diversifying your energy sources, but why else is it important to invest in clean sources?
So I think it's a combination of both the policy, the regulatory, the economic incentives, and the market and technological development that as you look at this over the next 10 years, you see there's enormous opportunity for further improvements in the efficiency and cost of these technologies. Because it's not a static situation. I mean, and we've seen the kind of trajectories that these technologies have gone. So, you know, that solar has dropped from, you know, 12 or 15 cents a kilowatt hour for grid solar down to 5 cents, 4 cents a kilowatt hour. I mean, I think the other thing I would say, though, is despite these trends, I think it's important for the U.S. to continue a substantial effort with regards to the carbon capture storage research and development. And I think that's important for Wyoming in particular in terms of future opportunities, in terms of any kind of breakthroughs in terms of coal. Because coal is going to be a major source of energy around the world for many years. And it's not going away right away.
That was energy and natural resources reporter Cooper McKim speaking with Dr. Eichhorn on issues and opportunities today in the world of energy.
When we come back, we'll share a conversation with U.S. Senate candidate Dave Dodson. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. A Jackson Republican is running a campaign on putting Wyoming first as he tries to upset incumbent U.S. Senator John Barrasso. Dave Dodson had intended to run as an independent because of his concerns about the current state of the Republican Party, but he decided to stick with his roots and run as a Republican. He says concerns about a range of topics, most notably health care, got him in the race. Dodson has several healthcare issues he wants to address.
First, fundamentally, we have a problem with healthcare money in politics. So the pharmaceutical industry gives more money to politicians or senators than any other industry. So 95 out of 100 senators take money from pharmaceutical industry. By the way, there's only 3 senators in all of America that take more money from the pharmaceutical industry than John Barrasso. So he takes a lot. And these are companies who can't find Wyoming on a map, let alone, you know, Laramie or Buffalo or any other town. So the first thing is there are industries that are not allowed, where executives from those industries are not allowed to give to political candidates because there's a conflict of interest, because the government's doing business with them, like municipal bonds, for example. We need the same rule in healthcare because those companies, their biggest customer is the U.S. government. So they can't give money to politicians. It is a clear conflict of interest. So that's one. I'll give you a second one is we are the only country in the world where the government is not allowed to negotiate prices with pharmaceutical companies. So what do you get? You get in the U.S. where a mother had to pay $609 for a box of or for an EpiPen, excuse me. And that same EpiPen in the U.K. costs $70, $609 versus $70. Why? Because we're the only country that can't negotiate pharmaceutical prices. And who does that benefit? It certainly doesn't benefit the consumers. Another example would be what drives down prices in pharmaceuticals is competition, especially generics. So I've got a number of ways to make it easier for generics to enter the market. But also, if there is not a generic alternative, you can buy it from countries like Canada and Australia and France and the UK. All of these come under the umbrella of this. I'm a capitalist. I made my money as a CEO starting and running businesses. I want to return competition to the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry. And Congress has protected them. And that's, you know, my party, the Republican Party, where the, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was the biggest trust buster of them all. Mm-hmm. Republicans love competition.
One of the things Republicans seem to love, or at least they have in the past, is a balanced budget. And we seem light years away from ever getting back to that again. How important is that? And do you think we have to at some point make some strides in that area?
It's not even a close call. Okay, we have $21 trillion in debt and climbing. But by the way, what people don't realize is that does not include the $100 trillion gap that we have in our obligations to Social Security and Medicare with receipts. So we're not $21 trillion in debt. We're $121 trillion in debt. These are the Congress's numbers, not Dave Dodson's numbers. And we have no plan to fix it. So we did a tax cut back in December, of which most of it went to people who did not need it. Frankly, people like me, and I didn't need it. And then we were promised spending cuts to offset it. And our Congress, with John Barrasso and others, passed the second highest spending bill in U.S. history. The Republicans used to be able to add and subtract. They can't add and subtract anymore. And so we are about to give our kids, or we basically have been giving our kids, the biggest credit card bill in U.S. history. And you think about it, whatever your issue is, whether it's national security or public service, roads, infrastructure, think how much worse that gets when we are in 17 years in a situation where seniors have to decide between reduced Social Security payments of about a third and heating their home.
Dave Dodson visiting with us. He's a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, talking about a number of issues. When I was looking through your campaign materials, I was interested in one, changing the way we save coal. I was curious if you'd talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so my granddad was in the coal business, and my great uncle was in the coal business, so two generations. And so it's a little bit in my heart. I think we've kind of missed the boat with coal. We've allowed coal to be the enemy to the environment. And I'm a realist, and I understand where coal is likely to end up in our total energy equation here. But for example, we should be exporting our coal to Japan and South Korea. We're not displacing wind. Japan has a problem now with nuclear energy. Both countries don't have the landmass for wind and solar. And so they are signers of the Paris Accords, and part of their formula is to burn clean, efficient coal. And we're denying them the opportunity to have the cleanest, most efficient coal, which is our Powder River Basin coal. And they're stuck with Australian coal or worse, Indonesian coal. So this is an example where we can help the balance of payments. We can create jobs for our transportation workers and our coal workers. We can save communities like Gillette and be part of the environmental solution. And in my, Dave's plan to put Wyoming first, I've got two other technical solutions that make coal part of the environmental equation. And not, we have to stop making environmentalists the enemy or environmentalists making coal the enemy. We have so many opportunities of overlap. And I think we've squandered that for the last decade.
Dave Dodson visiting with us, a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, wanted your thoughts on immigration. I'm sure you just love everything that's come out of Congress and in Washington, D.C. on this particular topic. But seriously, where do we need to be? And actually, where do we need to be? And then at the same time, how should we position ourselves so whatever we come up with doesn't hurt Wyoming but helps it?
Yeah, I think the immigration thing is appalling. Honestly, I mean, this has been going on for decades and multiple administrations with different parties. We have somehow allowed immigration to become a Democrat and Republican issue instead of the common sense issue that it is. Look, nobody thinks that you should be coming across the border at 2 o'clock in the morning with two kids on your arms in a dangerous environment, okay? Second, nobody thinks that you should be able to jump the line. Third is that nobody thinks an employer should be able to employ people who are here illegally, knowingly, and then have them rounded up and taken away, and the CEO goes, oops, sorry, and then turns around and does it again. I mean, these are basic things that everybody would agree on, and somehow we've allowed it to be competitive. So look, we do need to have secure borders. We don't need 2,500 miles of concrete. There's canyons, there's deserts, there's ranches, private land, but we need to make sure we have secure borders. Second, we need to be punishing to the CEOs that knowingly hire illegal people. Third is we're obviously going to have to then address some sort of seasonal visa issues when we realize once we have controlled and legal immigration, we may need a seasonal visa issue. The last part would be that we need to make sure that the people who are living in the shadows, I don't think they should be able to jump the line, but the people that are living in the shadows and they're going to be there and they're not paying taxes, that we get them out of the shadows and we make them taxpayers.
One last thing for you, and this is an issue that I haven't asked about in a lot of years, but it seems like it's an appropriate time again, is your thoughts on abortion.
Oh, in the United States, we have 600,000 abortions that happen every year. And that's a really sad number. And my goal is to get that down to zero. And again, it's a little bit to some extent like the immigration thing, is that the missed opportunity is to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies. And there's data out there to show that through education and access, both making it available and making it affordable, that we could greatly reduce the number of unintended pregnancies. And that's an area that both the, you know, pro-life and pro-choice people are in complete agreement on. And, you know, my plan, I actually have, it's not quite posted on my website yet, but I have a plan to reduce the number of abortions in my first term comfortably by 100,000. And so you can have a Senator John Barrasso, who flipped over from pro-choice to pro-life and hasn't done anything to reduce a single abortion, and Dave Dodson, who wants to get the number to zero, and he's got a way to get it to zero.
Are you pro? Would you call yourself pro-life?
I'm pro-reducing the number of abortions. You could say, okay, well, you know, you got to be one side or the other. I want to fix the problem. I want to take 600,000 abortions down to zero. All right. We've sort of reduced everything in life to pro fill in the blank instead of pro let's find a solution.
Dave Dodson, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you.
You can learn more about Dodson and read his Put Wyoming First plan at dodsonforsenate.com. When we come back, a story about a new effort by the University of Wyoming to help diversify the agriculture economy. This is Open Spaces.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Over the last year, Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson put together an award-winning series on sexual assault at the University of Wyoming. Watson's conversations with students revealed confusion about the reporting process and uncertainty about the university's willingness to take action. This spring, UW conducted a campus climate survey to get a better handle on the prevalence of sexual violence and what happens in its aftermath. Watson sat down with UW President Lori Nichols at her office to discuss the survey, the results, and what's next.
Why did this survey feel so critical, and what did you hope it would reveal that you wouldn't otherwise know?
The survey was suggested to me by the No More Committee, and this was a group of university individuals, including students, who have been really working with me on trying to address sexual assault and rape on campus and make our campus as safe as possible. I'm always a firm believer that having good data will really help inform decisions going forward. And we didn't have that. We had not done a survey like that, at least for some time, and I'm not even sure if we had really done that in the past. So we really felt like it was time to do so, and it would inform the committee as well as myself in terms of where we're at and what we need to do going forward.
The results of the survey were just released, and 27.1% of the 1,913 respondents who completed the survey reported experiencing at least one instance of sexual assault during their time here. But what really jumped out to me was that of the students who reported experiencing any type of sexual misconduct in the survey, around 53% of them had told someone about that incident or incidents previously, and 47% of them had not. And of those that did disclose, around 90% had told a close friend, 50% had told their roommate, but only 13% told a faculty or staff member. And then it gets even lower, 10% reported to the Dean of Students' Office or through some formal reporting mechanisms. So did this reluctance on the part of students to make an official report, did that surprise you?
It did a little. I mean, we know that the incidence of reporting is low. That's a national phenomenon. And if you read information about sexual assault on campuses, you know, the consensus nationally is that it's underreported and that every campus is faced with this challenge of trying to get reporting up. But, you know, was 10% a little overwhelming to me in terms of how low we are? It was. And the reality is that still only half, roughly, of students who are experiencing this are reporting it to really anyone. And then if you look at who they're reporting it to, we're bottom. The university is the lowest in terms of where students will turn when they're reporting an incidence of sexual assault. And I think in really at the end of the day, that is probably one of the most important findings from this survey, is that we're low and we have a lot of work to do. And that is thus why we wanted this information, is that we wanted to gauge where we're at. And it certainly opens the door for us and for the No More campaign to get to work on campus and see if we can impact that number. We need to try to move the number up in terms of the number of students who are reporting this to our campus authorities.
I have a question about the task force as well. Mm-hmm. There are people on that task force who are also responsible for these education, prevention, and response efforts, mm-hmm. which what that means is that if a student has a concern and they go to the task force, they're likely to face the same people that they feel mishandled their experience. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, what's your thinking about the composition of that group?
Yeah, and I think to some extent, you're probably bringing up the issue of what is the mission or the role of the task force? And do I see that as a sounding board whereby students that are unhappy or feel like they haven't been treated appropriately go to? I really don't. The task force was put in place because we wanted to pull together the individuals across campus who are in fact charged with and involved with sexual assault and rape cases. So these are the people. These are our go-to people. So this would be people like our police officers. It would be people like our student affairs personnel and our sexual assault office staff that work with this directly. So if you think about it, these are kind of feet on the ground, folks who are working against this every day to try to improve our campus. I don't see this as the sounding board whereby students would go to if they're unhappy. I think we need that, but it's not them.
And one of the other things that was addressed in the survey was the positive and negative role that UW plays. And it seemed like overall, there was a sense that the university played a positive role. But then when survivors of sexual misconduct at the university were asked, then their response was that the university did not play as positive a role.
What comes out of that message for me is that we need to do a much better job of training on our campus of our faculty and staff. Because in fact, when a student comes forward and has experienced this really traumatic incident in their life and are, you know, obviously traumatized from it, there are appropriate ways to respond and there are inappropriate ways to respond. And I suppose at some point there's maybe non-response that happens too. And we need to really work with our own employees to make sure that they understand what would be appropriate ways to respond to this. So, I mean, it is a time when showing empathy is really important, but it's also a time when we make referrals quickly so that we can immediately get students into the hands of people who are most prepared to work with them. And we do have those people on campus, but I think often that maybe is missed in that we aren't training adequately or appropriately so that people really know where those resources sit and how to quickly get those referrals done. So I think that there is a great amount of work we can do on training, and that's really one of the takeaway messages we've gotten from this survey too.
Great. I've been speaking with UW President Lori Nichols about the recently released Campus Climate Survey on Sexual Assault. President Nichols, thank you for your time.
You are welcome. Thank you for coming over today.
For a link to the results of the UW Campus Climate Survey on Sexual Assault, visit our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Changing gears, the University of Wyoming is embarking on a new age by increasing its interest on economic development and entrepreneurship. One new project is taking this vision even further by trying to develop a new niche ag market for the state, First Grains. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska finds the ultimate goal, profitability.
The idea came to Thomas Folk from France. He's a senior research scientist at the University of Wyoming College of Agriculture. He recently came back from an international trip for the college where he found a cookbook with a word he didn't understand.
The word is épeautre, which means spelt in English. And so I couldn't find this in my dictionary, so I went online and did the Google Translate, and I found spelt. And I thought, well, what is spelt?
Folk began researching spelt and found out that it's an ancestor of the most basic cereal crops, known as first grains. And he started thinking, can first grains be profitable for Wyoming?
That's kind of like what happened with beer. In the 80s, all of a sudden this craft brew revolution took place and people started looking for these different kind of beers and specialty crops, and now the craft brew industry is actually really vibrant. What if we did this with this grain?
It turns out that emmer wheat, a relative of spelt, was grown in Wyoming in the early 20th century. But Caitlin Youngquist, also with the project, says it didn't last long.
So it very well may have been that it was harder to process and harvest. It also, these ancient grains or these early grains tend to yield lower. And unless you can charge a premium for that product, you just can't make as good of a profit off of it.
And making it a premium product is how First Grains have been making a comeback, even with its challenges.
So the reason to grow it is similar to an organic product. You often will have lower yields, but you'll be able to sell your product at a premium. And so it provides another niche, another specialty market for producers and another option for them.
Some studies have also cited health benefits, such as regulating metabolism and controlling cholesterol levels, which can be attractive for consumers. First Grains never really fell out of favor in Europe because they make up a niche food market. And Youngquist says this can happen in Wyoming.
There is a lot of pride in local Wyoming products, and particularly if you are producing something that tastes good, that makes a really good beer or makes a really good bread or bakery product, that's going to, of course, increase your demand.
This is exactly what Thomas Folk envisions for Wyoming, a niche market around spelt and emmer products. But an obvious question lingers. Will Wyomingites buy into it?
We're going to try to market this, put it into places and see what the feedback is, the uptake from consumers, from brewers and restaurateurs and bakers.
This is the entire point of the project.
The university is taking the risk this first year with all of this before we start talking to people, then saying, hi, would you be interested in growing this?
So this summer, 27 acres of spelt and emmer is being grown at three UW research stations, Powell, Sheridan, and Lingle. The grains will be harvested sometime in August, and by then, Folk is hoping to have breweries, bakeries, and restaurants lined up who will be given the grains for free.
We're going to try to get some research back, some feedback from restaurants and brew pubs and what they did with the seed, how their malt or their flour, what kind of products they made, what kind of prices they charged, what the reception was from the public.
The idea is, eventually, the university will step back and Wyoming's First Grains brand, Neolithic, will be handed over to private hands, but under one condition.
This has to be profitable. It's not going to fly economically, and so nobody's going to want to grow it if it doesn't pay.
The real test will come this fall when producers find out if anybody is actually interested in emmer and spelt products. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Sheridan's Bill Dahlin is a long-distance runner who's competed in two Boston marathons and who's completed several ultra-marathons. He's hoping to use that mental toughness he's developed over the years and put it towards running the state as Wyoming's next governor. The Republican tells me that his goal is to diversify the state economy, and one of his ideas surrounds hemp.
People confuse that with marijuana. It's not marijuana. My dad wore hemp combat boots in World War II. They declassified it for World War II. Matter of fact, they had a song and a mantra about hemp for victory in World War II. Well, we've come a long way since then. We import about $1 billion worth of hemp products into this country right now and is scheduled to double in the next 2 to 5 years. It's a catalyst. It's not a cure-all. It's a catalyst to get us to think different and actually do something different in the state of Wyoming. It can grow here in Albany County. It can grow in Sheridan County. It can grow in, it's a three-month crop. It has 25,000 uses. It would touch the agriculture sector, transportation sector, logistics sector, and also the transportation sector. All those sectors would be benefited from industrial hemp, and we can start that by taking down barriers and allowing the people to proceed with it.
What other areas do you see the need? I'm sure you've been following what Endow's been doing and talking about. Are you on board with their ideas, or are there some other areas you'd like to see discussed?
When we talk about Endow, we got to talk about Wyoming Business Council. And for the listeners out there, Wyoming Business Council was developed 20 years ago for one purpose, and that was to diversify the economy in Wyoming. That's a failed model. That didn't work. And what we're doing with Endow is we're doubling down on top of that failed model with another governmental regulated entity that is actually doomed to fail the same way that Wyoming Business Council did. And what we're doing is we're just spending money. Wyoming Business Council, we spent about $1 billion of taxpayer money in 20 years to diversify our economy with no significant outcome. Endow has the same trajectory.
One of the things they are talking about, though, is the and even hired the state has a broadband coordinator to try and finally once and for all get broadband to some of these areas that don't have it. And the tech sector seems to be on the mind of a lot of people in the state. Do you think that's a good place to go?
I think infrastructure is part of the responsibility of government. Those two separate situations, though. And Dow doesn't have to have a purpose for infrastructure. The Wyoming Department of Transportation or some other entity could do that without adding another layer specific to that broadband. And I would look at working with the municipalities across the state to have them work for their own purposes and their own destination and their own destiny.
I think a segue there would be funding for municipalities. Years ago, we didn't want to commit tax money directly to municipalities and decided to fund it out of the general fund, and it's sending it, I think, $105 million. Are you satisfied with that? I know municipalities have come to the Revenue Committee and asked for ways that maybe they might make some more money with a local sales tax or more local sales taxes or something else. What's your thoughts on local government funding right now?
Well, I think, first of all, the state should be limited government. And the municipalities should have more authority to do what they need to do for their community. If the people in that municipality and the people in that government agree that they need to have more taxes to substantiate certain growth or certain areas, that's up to them. I don't have any issue with local government. That's where things should be actually transpiring as a local level, not at the state level.
Bill Dahlin visiting with us. He is your one of your Republican candidates for governor. Want to talk a little bit about health care and mental health, and both in the same vein. Do you have a plan for how we can get more medical providers to people in far-flung areas?
I do have a plan, and I think the focus would need to be on preventative health first and foremost. Hawaii, if you take a look at their state, they rate sometimes in the first place as far as their health concerns go in Hawaii. There's many other states, and the number one issue that they have to accomplish that is preventative health. And that's what, you know, when we have an automobile, we're driving an automobile and we have an accident, our insurance rates go up. But if we drive reasonable and prudent, our insurance stays at a certain level and it doesn't go up significantly. There should be no differentiation with that in our personal health. We should be responsible for our personal health, and preventative health care should be emphasized and pushed along the state lines in rural areas. Then we also get into telehealth, which is something that's coming down the pike. Technology will help our rural areas in the future greatly, and it gets back to the infrastructure for your broadband and things like that. Those are issues that will help our health industry. Mental health is severely lacking in Wyoming. We need to really emphasize and focus on mental health and preventative health care for the mental health sector too.
One of the things that continually comes up is that, you know, you have the energy industry that pays a lot in taxes, and then maybe the rest of us that don't pay all that much. I wondered if maybe reforming the tax system a little bit, lowering it for some of them and increasing it for some other businesses, isn't the way to go. What are your thoughts on that?
We do need to look at what we're spending right now. Maybe reform in some areas for vehicles or different things like that, but it would be less tax, not more tax. And the thing about taxing, if we raise taxes or address other taxes, that's not going to inspire the 8,500 people that left here in the last year and a half to move back so they can pay more taxes. People aren't leaving the state. They're leaving the state because of lack of opportunities. That's what we need to focus on first and foremost, and then how we spend our money.
Bill Dahlin, a pleasure having you stop by and joining us, and thank you very much. Good luck.
Well, thank you very much, and it's not too late for your listeners out there to just run down to the courthouse and get an absentee ballot. By ourselves as candidates, we can't do anything, but all of us working together, there's nothing we can't accomplish.
When we come back, we will take you on a journey to discover microbes. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. In the last few years, researchers have discovered the Earth is literally filled with microbes, those little single-celled critters we sometimes call germs. They've even been found living as deep as the Earth's core. They say these microbes could help us gain access to thousands of years of knowledge. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, now scientists at the University of Wyoming want to use those layers of ancient history to help us recover from wildfires as the climate warms up.
University of Wyoming geology researcher John Calder pumps up his rafts and sets out across an alpine lake in the Snowy Range, elevation nearly 11,000 feet. He says at the bottom of this high lake are undisturbed layers of living bacteria. Out on the water, his students, Caleb Fackrell and Zach Swainson, use a depth sounder to find the deepest spot in the lake.
So we get the deepest because that's where the most sediment per year will fall and accumulate on the bottom of the lake,
giving them a greater slice of history to look for microbes in. Once they find that deep spot, they lower down a large, clear tube called a gravity core. It has a plug on the top that Calder says works kind of like your thumb over the top of a straw to hold liquids inside the tube.
We can pop it slowly down to the bottom and it'll pick up like about a foot of mud or so.
Swainson squirms out on his belly across the raft to pull the tube out while Fackrell mans the rope.
How can you tell when it hits the bottom?
The rope slackens.
Yeah,
I just felt it snap.
Cool.
Okay.
So now we're pulling up. There's a little bit of
suction.
Oh, it's like hauling in a huge trout, and they're just as happy with it.
Keep it straight up. Keep it straight.
We got on a lot of mud, though.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
This is a lot of mud.
Yeah, we usually get
30 centimeters worth, to be exact. In lower elevation lakes, they might only get 1 centimeter. Calder says every centimeter represents more than 10 years of time. That means they've just pulled up 300 years of sediment. And by studying this mud, they can understand how microbes got buried in the earth in the first place. Calder says when plants, or even a burnt log from a fire, fall in the water, it all drifts down to the bottom, carrying microbes with it. That matter turns to muck, but the microbes go on living, just very, very slowly.
Their ancestors are there, and it looks like the same community that was on the surface hangs out below, and they slowly reproduce in really inhospitable conditions.
Calder says there's a lot of underground microbes, almost as many by weight as there is life on top of the earth. And the diversity of these critters is vast, in the trillions, each playing a role in the environment. Calder says ever since DNA sequencing came along, it's been a golden age in microbe research. And Calder says if you really dig that kind of work, Wyoming is the place to be.
Wyoming's good because we don't have that many people. We have so few people that we've got landscapes that have been relatively untouched.
Untouched and wide-ranging, from high mountains to low deserts, from hot springs to archaeology sites. And thanks to a $20 million grant by the National Science Foundation, UW is now sending out an army of scientists to take samples around the state. The crew puts the tube of lake mud on dry ice and takes it to a lab at UW where a new robot will process all the samples. Botany researcher Joshua Harrison is one of the robot's handlers.
The first step in the process is to do the DNA extraction. Basically, what that entails is breaking up the cells and getting the DNA in solution.
He punches some buttons and the machine comes to life. Harrison says this machine will help speed up the process of cataloging the huge array of microbes that have already started pouring in from all over the state. UW geology professor Brian Schumann says the robot will help them literally squeeze a lot of data out of these microbes, and fast.
It does feel like this brand new arena where we know this is important, but we don't know who's out there and what they do.
So new that it's not entirely clear how they'll apply all this science. But one goal is to create products with these microbes to help people deal with a warming climate that has played a role in more wildfires. Schumann says the idea isn't as far-fetched as you might think. In fact, he says the microbe industry started in Wyoming.
Some of the microbes that were found in hot springs in Yellowstone actually led to a major revolution in genetic studies, which is kind of surprising, but has launched a whole sort of biotech industry.
And now the microbe industry is worth billions of dollars. People use them in pharmaceuticals, to make clothes, to ferment food. Schumann says UW researchers are also testing to see whether certain microbes could be used to eat up oil spills in sensitive landscapes. Some of those microbes we dredged up from the Alpine Lake might have practical applications too. Who knows? Some microbes might find charcoal delicious. If released onto a burned landscape, they might make the soil fertile again for plants and trees to flourish. Out on the lake, researcher John Calder says as the climate warms, more fires are expected to ravage the West.
We're racing against the clock to understand future climate change, and so we're racing to understand the past in hopes to better be prepared.
And Calder says the key to getting prepared may be hiding in layers of mud thousands of years old. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Over the next week, dance students from all around the state will come to the University of Wyoming to learn from renowned performers as part of the Snowy Range Summer Dance Festival. This year's event will feature dancers from the Limon Dance Company based in New York City. They will teach throughout the week, then dance a performance at the festival's gala on July 28th. Logan Francis Kruger is a member of and the rehearsal director for the Limon Dance Company. She told Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard that her history with the company started when she was very young.
I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, studying modern dance from the age of 7, and was really lucky to be introduced to the Limon Company at the age of 9. I had a student of my teacher who had gone on to join the company, and she brought us up to New York in the summers to train with the company. So I've been doing this work pretty much my whole life, and was lucky enough then to, after college, join the company, and I've been there now for 9 years.
For those who might not be familiar with him, can you tell me a little bit about José Limón?
Sure. José Limón was born in Culiacán, Mexico in 1908, and his family emigrated to California when he was about 8 years old, fleeing the war in Mexico at the time. And he grew up, his father was a musician, so he was always around music, but he didn't find his way to dance until much later, until he was in his 20s. He actually made his way to New York to try to be a painter. And someone took him to a dance concert, and he was like, oh, that's what I want to do. And started studying dance in his 20s, and then really went on to become one of the greatest male dancers of his time, and incidentally, one of the most important choreographers in the canon of American modern dance. I think there's something about being a fully realized adult by the time you enter into a new craft, that he was able to really bring a lot of himself to it. He knew who he was. He knew these very rich experiences that he already had. So I do think that that informed his choreography, the theater of his choreography.
In your view, what sets the Limon Dance Company apart from other companies?
I think that the work is unique in its universality. Physically, we work with the ideas of being bound by gravity and resisting gravity, which everyone can relate to. Everyone has to resist gravity to get out of bed in the morning. So there's something that even someone who has no experience dancing can watch and identify with. Also, the humanistic values of the work. We're really watching people explore the human experience and explore their vulnerability, and it's quite beautiful to watch, I think.
What is your role at the Snowy Range Dance Festival?
I will be teaching modern classes, improvisation classes, and also staging a piece of Limon repertory for some of the students. And then at the end of the festival, myself and 3 other members of the Limon Company will be performing.
What do you enjoy about working with young dancers?
I love working with young dancers so much, mostly because I think they're not set in their ways yet. And they're able to explore and take risks and try something new without feeling like, oh, I can't do that. Someone told me once I shouldn't ever move my head that way. You know, they're much more willing to explore and try new ideas.
You mentioned about young dancers sort of being malleable.
Yes.
Right. In what ways do you think that's important in the dance world specifically?
Mm-hmm. I think generally choreographers and directors are looking for dancers who are open to taking risks. That is what is exciting to watch on stage. At the end of the day, you can be really safe and execute your movements, but the audience gets a thrill from watching someone take a chance.
The Summer Dance Festival takes place July 18th through the 28th. What all will the students be doing?
They will be dancing their little hearts out. They'll be taking a ton of classes of all different varieties, right? From ballet to point to jazz to modern, exploring some improvisation and composition and learning rep or learning new pieces of choreography that are being made on them while they're here.
Can you tell me a little bit about what's going to be featured in the gala performance of the Limón Dance Company on July 28th?
Yes. So you will see some of the students from the University of Wyoming performing a suite from A Choreographic Offering, which is a dance that Limón choreographed, and a new piece by one of our company members, Jesse Obremski. And additionally, you will see the Limón Company performing a work called The Moor's Pavon, which is one of Limón's masterpieces, and it's a classic. It's an incredible dance. And a solo called Chacon, which will actually be danced by three people. So a solo for three.
As both the rehearsal director and as a dancer, what are you most looking forward to during the festival?
I'm really looking forward to staging this piece of rep on some of the students of the festival. I love sharing the legacy of this work with other dancers because it means so much to me and it has really influenced me not only as a dancer but as a human and the way that I look at the world. And so to be able to share that with people and pass that on is really a gift.
Logan Francis Kruger is a member and the rehearsal director of the Limón Dance Company. Logan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Snowy Range Summer Dance Festival will give a final performance Saturday, July 28th at 4 at Laramie High School.
Thanks again for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed a part of the program or would like to hear it again, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. There you can find individual segments and you can sign up for our podcast there or wherever you get your Apple Podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We'd love to get good ideas for future segments and interviews. You can send them to us and you can also comment on our stories on our website or on our Facebook page. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.